Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Award-winning music critic Alex Ross was turned on to music as a child by just these strains, the opening measures of Beethoven's Eroica Symphony, conducted by Leonard Bernstein. It made a big impression. He listened to only classical music until the age of 20. That was then. The celebrated critic has long since broadened out. Now he's taking us with him. Sonic Youth, Radiohead, Nirvana, Bob Dylan, and artists you've probably never heard of, from Alaska to China, plus Wagner, Handel, and Lorraine Hunt Lieberson. This hour on Point, we're deep in the music with Alex Ross. You can join the conversation. Are you a purist or a polymath when it comes to music? And do you want your music to comfort or to stretch? And stretch where? Our phone lines are down today, but you can join us via the website onpointradio.org with your comments and questions, or via Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And we're very happy to have you in any of those three. Joining me right now from Berkeley, California is Alex Ross, music critic for The New Yorker since 1996. Made a big splash with his first book, The Rest is Noise, Listening to the 20th Century. His latest is a collection of his best writing from a decade and more. It's called Listen to This. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. You can also link out to excerpts of the music that he is critiquing here. Alex Ross, welcome. Welcome back to On Point.
Oh, it's great to be back, Tom.
It's great to have you with us. And there's Beethoven's Eroica right behind us. Take us back to when it grabbed you by the earlobes or the lapels and sort of what made you a prisoner of classical till you were 20. What happened?
Oh, well, it was very natural for me. I mean, my parents had a very nice record collection. They took me to concerts from a pretty early age. I started plinking away on the piano pretty early on. And so this music was around me as long as I can remember. But I remember with the Eroica Symphony, this is when it really moved to the foreground and just, you know, put me under its spell. And this piece, I mean, it's a revolutionary piece. It had an enormous impact when it was first played and has continued to have that impact, you know, right through to today. And I was just, you know, one of many thousands of victims. And it's just so remarkable because the conflict never lets up. You know, right from the beginning, you have a sense of forces colliding, and it takes 45 minutes for Beethoven to resolve those tensions. And I don't think music had ever quite worked this way. I mean, it's a novel in sound or a landscape. It's an incredibly complex thing, and no one has ever exhausted it or gotten to the bottom of it.
I guess we're all virgins to each piece of music just once. You write about the first-time listener as actually a hero, him or herself, in this piece, kind of the missing link that makes it whole again.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Beethoven was always thinking of the audience, this potentially vast audience. I think he meant it very personally when he set the line, "Be embraced, you millions," in the Ninth Symphony. I mean, this is the scale on which he was thinking. And the listener is absolutely important. I think the listener is a protagonist in this great conflict, this great story. It's not a self-contained organism. It's not an intellectual object. It's a deeply emotional relationship.
You're writing across a big range, and listen to this. We're going to be listening across a big range. It should be fun. Listeners really respond to that. Our phone lines are down, but people are giving us their comments. Here's Judy at Facebook picking right up on the feeling. She writes, "I'm undone by the end of Wagner's Die Walküre, Mozart's Suave Sia il Vento, Matthew Sweet's Girlfriend, Los Lobos, especially live, Van Morrison's Tupelo Honey, Ella singing Ellington, and the Beastie Boys' Sabotage. Who cares about genre?" She's right in your wheelhouse, Alex.
That's a good list. That's a very nice playlist right there. Yes, and I think that your emotion is the bottom line, as it were. And I think for too long, classical music has been seen as the art of the intellect or the art of a certain social circle status and so on. But these composers were deeply emotional people. You know, if you read Beethoven talking about his music, he's not analyzing it bar by bar. He's saying, from the heart, may it go to the heart. And so this is one great universal. And the fascinating question of how does music do this? How does it get under our skin and activate our emotions just with a few notes?
You write about some commonalities in how it does that, and you give us this wonderful kind of line of descent here of the bass line. Maybe we can look right at Beethoven and then take it. Let's listen here into Henry Purcell's Dido's Lament. This is soprano Gillian Fisher singing Dido's Lament from Dido and Aeneas. Let's listen. Dido's Lament, Gillian Fisher. Music critic Alex Ross helps us find a connection to something of an entirely different era. That was 1688. Here's 1975. Bob Dylan, A Simple Twist of Fate. Listen for the bass line.
He woke up. The room was bare. He didn't see her anywhere. He told himself he didn't care. Pushed the window open wide. Felt that emptiness inside, to which he just could not relate. Brought on by a simple twist of fate.
Alex Ross, what are you hearing there in the bass line connection?
Well, it's a bass line that goes down step by step, the chromatic scale. Think of consecutive notes on a piano keyboard, black and white. It's a pattern that's very, very old and has always been associated with feelings of sorrow, of lament. Going all the way back to the Renaissance period, people were talking about this property of this stepwise descent and how it is associated with sadness. And so it keeps recurring again and again in musical history. And this is something I follow in the chapter I wrote for this new book, which hadn't appeared in the New Yorker previously, Chacona Lamento, Walking Blues. And I think it is some kind of deep code in music because that descent seems to resemble the sounds we make when we're in distress, sighs and sobs and cries.
And finds
and
us
so
where we are.
And so it's imitating that.
Yeah, and kind of walks us down. And you let us hear it there in the aria with Gillian Fisher and Bob Dylan. And you got one more, Willie Brown, Future Blues, the blues man with that same descending chromatic. This is about 1930. And we've walked from Dido and Aeneas to Dylan to Willie Brown, and there again, it just catches us wherever we are and plucks us right down that chromatic, Alex.
Absolutely. I think sometimes it's intentional. You know, Beethoven in the Ninth Symphony very deliberately uses this figure in the first movement to create this funeral atmosphere in the darker stages of that great heroic story in the Ninth Symphony. He's thinking back to Bach, probably, because Bach in the Mass in B minor uses this bass line to represent the crucifixion. Sometimes I think it's unintentional. It's just a figure that people in different world musical cultures reach for naturally to represent sorrow or some other darker emotion. And I don't think we can say that these notes have that intrinsic meaning. You know, they can mean other things, but there's definitely this tendency toward lament. And so that's the story I tell in that chapter of my book. And I find it just thrilling to jump from one genre to another just by following the adventures of these notes.
I think it's pretty difficult to, pretty slippery to get into intention and unintention there. I mean, when it comes to music, you know, what Beethoven feels it, Bach feels it, Willie Brown feels it in addition to knowing it. I love the title of this new book, Listen to This. I mean, how many times have you heard that? Somebody's listening to music, something's just catching them, and they turn to a friend and say, listen to this, and they mean a particular passage. And I guess what they're saying, Alex, is listen to the what they're doing here and listen to the impact of it on yourself, on your ear, on your soul.
Absolutely. It's about enthusiasm and about passion, and I think this has been missing to some extent from the discussion around classical music, which is my, you know, deepest, longest lasting passion in terms of music. You know, we tend to say, you might want to listen to something like this. And I would really like to bring it up a notch in a way and show that passion when I talk about music. And I think younger musicians now in classical music are really showing more of themselves in the art, and that's a very good thing.
Here's that bass line going all the way to Led Zeppelin, Dazed and Confused. New Yorker music critic Alex Ross is with us. His new book is Listen to This. You can read an excerpt at our website, get excerpts from his musical collection there. Our phones are down today, but we're very happy for your comments at onpointradio.org. What do you want from music? Comfort? Challenge? The secrets of the age? Can you, do you love Beethoven and Bjork? Onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with New Yorker music critic Alex Ross about his obsessions, our obsessions with music, from Beethoven to Bjork behind us there to Radiohead. You can join us today. Can you, do you love Beethoven and Bjork? Have you read Alex Ross on Verdi, Schubert, Brahms, on Sonic Youth, Nirvana, Bob Dylan? And how wide is your musical taste? Not theoretically, but what you actually listen to. How do you get exposed to new music? Friends? Zumba class? Whatever your radio gives you? We're at 800-423-825. Oh, I'm sorry, we're not. Force of habit. Our phone lines are down. But we're very happy to have your questions and comments at our website, onpointradio.org, or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Alex Ross joins us today from Berkeley, California. And Alex, you are big on Bjork. You write about Bjork inhabiting a kind of utopia where, quoting you here, music is restored to its original bliss, free both of the fear of pretension that limits popular music and the fear of vulgarity that limits classical music. Expand, please.
Well, you know, I'm a lucky guy to have my job, and one of the luckiest things was getting to meet Bjork and spending time with her and watching her work, because, you know, if there's a genius alive today in music, Bjork certainly is she, is it. And I love her vast perspective on music. She takes from everything, folk music, classical music, pop, rock, everything else under the sun, and she's always discovering new things. And I think this is an important power that music has to expand our horizons. And I think we should all be challenging and pushing the boundaries of our taste, because, you know, I think we too often use music as a kind of comfort to confirm what we already know instead of leading us to new things and new places and new people. So Bjork is extraordinary that way. And of course, I love how she embraces classical music and isn't afraid of being associated with it as if it's going to sort of take away her, you know, popular cred. She loves it, and you can hear it in her music.
What do your classical fans, reading fans, but classical lovers say when you go big on Björk? I mean, for example, here we've got a comment from Facebook from Brian. He says, "Ah, Beethoven. When I hear anything from Beethoven, I feel I can hear his soul. He puts so much of himself into his music." And there's no two ways about it. There's no denying it. But do your Beethoven readers, lovers, Alex, turn around and say, "Oh, yeah, Björk, let's go"?
Some of them don't, admittedly. But I think they're willing to, you know, at least entertain the idea of checking out this music. And if they don't like it, if they don't go for it, that's no problem. I mean, I actually don't know of that many people who listen only to classical music. I mean, I was a strange case when I was growing up because I was so so devoted to classical music that I tuned out everything else. But, you know, so many people, you know, there's certain kinds of pop music that they grew up with, and a lot of classical people who also know, older Broadway musicals and all the great popular standards, thinking especially of the older generations. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they may not be following Björk and Radiohead. But I think on principle, not many people object to the idea of a music critic sometimes reaching out and embracing music outside of his or her specialty.
You were lucky to spend a lot of time with Björk and all over the place. And at one point she tells you, and I wish you'd explain this a little bit. She says to you, Björk says, "Everyone loves Maria Callas because she doesn't get locked up in a technique box. She keeps her RRR, you spell that. She gestured toward her chest, you say then, the unity of emotion and word and tone." What exactly is Björk talking about there, Alex?
Oh, that's something very fundamental, and I think this is a lesson that applies in a lot of different genres. I mean, of course, you think of classical music, and this is a sharp critique of something that's happened in classical performance, I would say, over the past century, where a lot of people have become so caught up in precision, in the exact execution of the notes on the page, you know, with dazzling virtuosity, that they've sometimes neglected the more emotional end of things. And, you know, sometimes I hear a great orchestra, you know, at the very peak of its powers playing Beethoven, and there's something missing. And, you know, I might go to a community orchestra performance where, you know, all the notes aren't in place, but there's a kind of happy energy. You know, it's a student orchestra performances always have a bit more oomph to them. So, you know, that's what she's talking about. You know, as Callas, you know, reached the zenith of her fame, she still kept a certain savagery, a certain intensity in her voice. But, you know, it can happen in pop music, mm-hmm. too, where everything mm-hmm. is being auto-tuned and sort of lined up precisely in the studio and, you know,
right.
someone's, you know, doing the same show night after night after night, and it very easily becomes a routine, and you lose touch with that primal urge that drove you at the beginning. So the technique box is a universal danger in music.
Imprisoned by precision or maybe technique. Our listeners are really curious how far you take your savoring, Alex Ross. Here's Tony on Facebook says, "What about contemporary improv-based music, jam rock like The Grateful Dead or Phish, where the band and the audience create a synergistic experience? Are you willing to go there?" And then here's another from the website says, to you, our classical and more guy, "Are you into metal too, dude? Tool rules, metal should not be dismissed." Okay, what do you say?
Dude, absolutely. You know, there are limits kind of to my time and just sort of ability to absorb so many kinds of music. I mean, I've dabbled in a lot of things. I've listened to a bit of the Grateful Dead and a bit of sort of various metal bands, kind of death metal. You know, there's some great dark weird stuff there, but there's so much. I mean, you just sort of look at all the genres that exist today, and you're not going to be able to absorb all of them. But, you know, hopefully, kind of, you know, piece by piece, I can sort of make my own way through this landscape. I mean, right now I've been spending a lot of time trying to listen to world music and Indian and African music and East Asian music. And there's just so much. I mean, in a whole lifetime, you can never hear enough.
It's kind of overwhelming to be a music critic in this globalized age. I mean, what, 100 years ago, you'd hear what was in front of you. And now we hear, you can hear everything, anything, all the time.
Yeah, it approaches the infinite, you know, with the internet. You know, you go on the internet, this, you know, music from streaming from all over the world, you know, concerts. You go to a website devoted to, you know, Australian music, and there's 500 contemporary Australian composers, and I sometimes just have a little meltdown, you know, because I think, oh, my God, you know, sort of the next, you know, great composer is somewhere on this sort of list, and if I can only, you know, find it and... it is baffling, and I think this is actually why music critics are useful. I think we are filters in a way. We are guides, you know, in this incredible, you know, assault almost of possibilities. We say, well, you know, try this, and I think that's a useful role to play.
Well, okay, then here's a question from Charlie in Boston from the website. And looks like he may be a professional classical musician. He says, I enjoy Alex's columns in The New Yorker and wonder what advice he would give a young professional looking to add intellectual enjoyment of music in addition to the intrinsic response. I mean, you write about Sonic Youth and Radiohead. Those might be a couple of examples. I don't know. Alex?
In terms of?
Adding intellectual enjoyment to intrinsic response.
Or
do you hear them as sort of, you know, going for the gut?
Well, I think the idea is it always helps to know the context of a certain kind of music. I mean, you can just sort of listen to the sound itself, and sometimes the sound is all you need to know, and it sort of speaks for itself. But I think when you get into, you know, the contemporary musical world and all its diversity, or if you're looking at the history of classical music, and especially the 20th century, where things move very fast and there are these very surprising changes, it helps to know why people made certain choices and what was going on around them socially, politically, and everything else. And then you can just sort of keep it in mind as you begin to listen, and you may forget, and the sound may take over, but it's a very useful jumping off point.
And the borders fall down in a hurry, of course, and have fallen down for a long time. And here's a comment from Richard on the website. Says, a teachable moment for me came when my kids heard Gilbert and Sullivan and asked if it was Freddie Mercury. This started a conversation about how derivative all music is. Pink Floyd listened to Booker T and the MGs. Bowie listened to Kurt Weill. And couldn't be more true. You're writing in these essays, revised here, and with the new material as well, across a big span. You write about Sonic Youth a little bit, Teenage Riot. We're going to play an excerpt from us. Tell us what you hear, what you listened for when you listened to Teenage Riot from, this is a 1988 album, Daydream Nation. Alex, we're going to hear it. What do you listen for here?
Well, you know, Sonic Youth, they come out of punk, but they just up the noise factor. And so there's this sense of dissonance and sort of tones colliding and it's sort of moving from like a very simple, almost brutal kind of music to something artier and a very kind of smart incorporation of lots of different sounds. And they're always kind of swaying back and forth in that border between simple melody and noise.
Let's hear a little. Teenage Riot, 1988, Sonic Youth.
Everybody's talking about the stormy weather. What's it meant to go work out weather? Looking for a man with a focus and a temper who can open up a map and see between one and two. Time to get it before you let.
Sonic Youth, Teenage Riot, 1988. They make Alex Ross's world, as does Radiohead in a big way. In his new book, Listen to This, he writes that Radiohead in 1997 caught a wave of generational anxiety. Their album, OK Computer, you know, with paranoid android karma police climbing up the walls, pictured the onslaught of the information age and the young person's panicky embrace of it. York's lyrics in Radiohead seemed a mixture of overheard conversation, techno-speak, and fragments of a harsh diary. Let's listen to a little of that airbag from Radiohead, 1997's OK Computer. Radiohead with Airbag. Alex Ross writes about them and much more in his new book, Listen to This. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Alex, what makes you a Radiohead fan?
You know, they're a fascinating group, and I think they're so, you know, a bit like Björk. They're sort of constantly pushing the borders of what they do and rethinking their music. I think, especially in pop music, so easily fall into repeating whatever the sound was that first caught people's attention. And Radiohead haven't been afraid to challenge their audience, even alienate their audience at times in the name of evolving and not repeating themselves. But they're very musically sophisticated. I think Radiohead are an indication of the power of music education because in school, they all went to school together in Abingdon, England. They had a great music teacher who just guided them through lots of different kinds of music, including a lot of 20th century classical music. So their harmonies are just richer than average, and their sort of sense of timbres and the sounds they bring into play, it's just a very wide kind of vocabulary that they have. So, you know, in Airbag, there's something kind of a little shadowy about these chords. You know, the technical term is flat sixth. There's a chord there based on the flattened sixth note of the scale, and there's always these sort of twinges and these kind of odd turns and chords pivoting one to another on a single note that's held, and it never quite does what you think it's going to. And at the same time, it always sounds like Radiohead, which I think is a fascinating phenomenon, these five guys coming together and creating a personality in sound, this kind of Radiohead composer that doesn't exist. You know, there is no such person, but when they get together, that musical personality emerges. I think, you know, the same thing happened with the Beatles. You know, Lennon plus McCartney plus George Harrison and Ringo Starr, you know, made up a personality that none of them individually could replicate.
We've got Andrew asking you here about the advent of iPods, encouraging, he writes, the invasion of music into every aspect of our lives. Isn't there a concomitant decline in the quality of our listening when it's everywhere all the time, maybe? What do you say, Alex?
It could be, but I wouldn't blame the iPod. You know, I mean, for a long time now, music has been piped in you know, restaurants and sort of public spaces, and I think actually people often use the iPod to block out this kind of constant stream of other people's music and just kind of, you know, general random sound and sort of creating a little cocoon for themselves. And that might be kind of a healthy way of maintaining sanity. But, you know, there is a danger to it. I mean, first of all, having those earphones in your ears all the time really can damage your hearing. That's something people should be aware of. And, you know, you want to have that active kind of listening. You want to be focused on the music right in front of you. You don't want to always use it as a kind of comfortable background, which is why I think, you know, the live concert still has such power, because it forces you to listen to what someone else thinks you should be listening to and not just to your own personal playlist.
We'll go out with Nirvana. We'll come back with Joan Sutherland, Wagner, and more. Alex Ross is with us, music critic for The New Yorker. His new book, a collection of essays, quite wonderful, is Listen to This. You can join us. Our phone lines are down, but we're at onpointradio.org. What do you want from music? Onpointradio.org or onpointradio at Twitter, at Facebook. Alex Ross, stand by in Berkeley. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with New Yorker music critic Alex Ross about his obsessions, our obsessions with music from Beethoven to Bjork to right here Joan Sutherland singing Casta Diva, the aria from Norma, the great soprano, died Sunday at the age of 83, the Vincenzo Bellini opera there, singing in 1963. You can join the conversation this hour, not by the phone, sorry, there on the blink, but via our website at onpointradio.org. What do you want from music? Comfort? Challenge? The secrets of the age? And what's your big musical question for our big listener, big thinker on music? People are paying close attention here. Alex, here's a tweet. Love the Dido's Lament, Dylan Zeppelin parallel. Classical music for everyone. Our communicant writes right there. And here's Frank saying, I play in a Celto-eclectic band, play in a blues jam band, play at bluegrass, old-time Americana jams, listen to classical, to hard rock, to jazz, to country, to funk. Occasionally, I wonder if people think I'm a poser, but I really do love a wide spectrum. And we say, you say, Alex Ross, why not? I want to put right up against Joan Sutherland, if I could for a second here, Marian Anderson. You write about her in your new book, Listen to This. You call her the voice of the century. Here she is, singing the traditional spiritual, Deep River. Marian Anderson with Deep River. Alex Ross, you write about her with so much affection and admiration. How does she gain the Voice of the Century label? And think about her for just a minute, up against Joan Sutherland, who we just heard, who's gone in the last week. Marian Anderson, Joan Sutherland.
Well, these are voices that do have a kind of a primal effect on us. When we hear them, we stop what we're doing. There's something in the timbre. There's a kind of aura around the sound that puts us under its spell. Marian Anderson, it was actually Toscanini who called her the voice of the century, the kind of voice that comes along once in 100 years. And, you know, what happened in the 1930s, her talent was so remarkable, and unfortunately, the recordings, most of the recordings we have were done later, and even if recordings had been done at that time, they couldn't have captured this aura that people said she had. Her talent was just so obvious that it was an outrage when, you know, in 1939 she was barred from singing in Constitution Hall because she was African American, and this historic concert took place on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, which was a great moment in American civil rights. It was not just a musical event; it was a titanic political event in a way. And there were resonance of it at Barack Obama's inauguration when Aretha Franklin sang the same song, My Country, 'Tis of Thee, that Marian Anderson so memorably sang on that occasion. I think it must have been an intentional echo. Martin Luther King, too, recited the lyrics of that song at the end of I Have a Dream, and he surely was thinking of Marian Anderson because he had written about her in his youth. So this is a very singular phenomenon, I think. Marian Anderson, a great musical talent who also played an enormous political role. You know, Joan Sutherland obviously was just a great singer, and there are political resonances that I know of in her career. But she was vital. You know, she took a repertory that a lot of people had dismissed, this bel canto repertory, Donizetti, Bellini, that people had come to think of as decorative and sort of just, you know, mere vocal display. And she brought a kind of grandeur back to it and an emotional point, as well as actually singing the notes in a way that you know, took the breath away with the precision that she was able to achieve. I never got to see her live, so I'm probably not the best person to eulogize her, but obviously there are so many great documents on recording.
We want to keep getting your introductions, keep crossing borders with you. You start right off saying, I hate classical music, in quotes, not the thing but the name. It traps a tenaciously living art in the theme park of the past. And you're tough on that front. You say for at least a century, the music has been captive to a cult of mediocre elitism that tries to manufacture self-esteem by clutching at empty formulas of intellectual superiority. But you point us very strongly in all kinds of new waves as well. Let's listen to one of those. This is the composer, the Alaskan composer, John Luther Adams. Here's a 2007 composition for orchestra and electronic sound called Dark Waves. Alex, that really caught me. John Luther Adams' Dark Waves. I happen to have spent a lot of time quite alone in very dark Alaskan nights, but you do not have to have done that to be grabbed by the throat, the heart, by John Luther Adams. What's going on there, Alex?
Oh, he's an amazing guy. And of course, you know, a lot of people have heard of John Adams, the composer of Nixon in China and Dr. Atomic. This is a different John Adams, right. John Luther Adams, who moved to Alaska in the 70s. He was actually very involved in environmental activism at that time, lobbying for the Alaska Lands Act. And he fell in love with the place and for a long time was living in a cabin outside of Fairbanks with no hot water and sort of just doing the real wilderness lifestyle. And he has settled into this style of remarkable music that really seems to evoke the vastness of Alaska. It moves very slowly and builds and builds. It's not the kind of music where you can sort of, you know, expect to get it in a minute or two. You have to sit with it. He's created a piece actually in Fairbanks at the Museum of the North, which is infinite. It's playing right now. It's going to be playing indefinitely because it's a piece based on seismological data and meteorological data, and it's fed into a computer program that he created, and it generates sound. So whatever is going on outside in the landscape and in the weather is reflected in the fluctuations of the music. And you know, this man is a remarkably original composer, and he has a vision that goes far beyond music to the environment and the place of our species in the world. And he thinks very deeply on these subjects.
I love it, and you can hear it in John Luther Adams. I mean, that the sort of Northern Lights in there, and that almost edgy metallic depth of very, very deep, maybe Alaskan cold. Let's go in another direction. You're such a great guide. Here's another I don't know at all. You write about a Chinese composer, Guo Wenqing. Introduce us, Alex.
This is a composer who has been, you know, living through all the changes in China over past decades. He survived the Cultural Revolution and has sort of uncomfortably been on the edge of official life and in and out of it, and just an independent thinker. And there are some Chinese composers who came to the West, Tan Dun and others, and established their name here. And he is much less known, but I think he is an important talent, and maybe slightly in the same way that John Luther Adams is, someone very much kind of the earth and reflecting certain feelings of the landscape, especially Sichuan province where he's from.
In the south. Let's listen. This is Guo Wenqing. This is his piece, Zhou Kong Shan, Sorrowful, Desolate Mountain. Alex Ross writes about his melding of Western technique with Chinese tradition. Sorrowful, Desolate Mountain from Chinese composer Guo Wenqing. I want to turn it right around from China to the stage right now in New York City. Here's baritone Eric Owens as the dwarf Albrecht in the Metropolitan Opera's blockbuster new production of Richard Wagner's Das Rheingold. Here's a scene where Albrecht places a powerful curse on a magic ring he has forged after Wotan, king of the gods, has stolen it from him.
Nach seinem Gut, doch keine genieße mit Nutzen dein. Und auf Ufe hüllt ihn sein Herr, doch ein Würger zieht er ihm zu. Dem Tode verfallen, fesseln den Feigen die Furcht. Solange er lebt, sterbe Lächsen dahin, es bringe es her, was es bringe es nicht.
Wow, and the breath is gone. Alex Ross, what do you make of this? This very techie, giant, sort of amazing sensory set and the performance itself as a music critic. That's Rheingold.
Yeah, well, I write about it in this week's New Yorker. The production was only so-so for me. It definitely had its moments, some great spectacular effects. But in terms of really getting deep into the world of this monumental piece of music, Wagner's Ring Cycle, I felt like it has a ways to go, but hopefully it will deepen as we reach the further stages of the cycle. What really stood out for me, and I think for a lot of people as well, some listeners may have seen the broadcast, the movie theater broadcast last Saturday, was Eric Owens singing Alberich, the dwarf lord. Wotan is really supposed to be the center of the thing, but Eric Owens was singing so strongly that he almost took over the opera.
Right.
And this is the first time he'd ever sung Wagner, and he immediately revealed himself as having this exactly the kind of voice that we want in Wagner, powerful, but with many nuances, and he seems to be talking as he's singing, so each word registers, and the emotion. You know, Alberich, he seems like the villain, but he has been wronged. He is also a victim, and Eric Owens really brought that out as that curse is delivered. As long as he lives, may he long to die. The Lord of the Ring is the slave of the ring, reminding you that Wagner, you know, Wagnerian has become a synonym for mm-hmm. grandiosity, and it's sort of used carelessly that way. You know, Wagner was actually a critic of power, and the entire Ring cycle is a brilliant and meticulous mapping out of how power corrupts, how money enslaves us, and that's what the Ring symbolizes. And Eric Owen sort of lets you know where all this is going as he's singing those lines.
Here's a comment from Elizabeth. Love this show. I'm a theatrical sound designer, composer. I do listen to Beethoven and Bjork. Black metal and Anthony Braxton. One does inform the other. And what do I want from music? She writes, exactly what it does and exactly how I use it in my job, maybe in life, to move me and to move others. We're going to test you for 2 seconds right here. Here is top of the Billboard Hot 100 chart right now, Just the Way You Are, a Hawaiian-born singer-songwriter, Bruno Mars. Alex, top 100, is it ever on your earbuds or your stereo or not that not in your world?
I have to say, this is new to me. You know, I've seen the name. It sounds familiar now that you're playing it.
Sounds familiar to everybody. It sounds like a top 100.
Yeah, I'm a little behind here. You know, this is where Sasha Fear Jones, my colleague from The New Yorker, could pop in and tell you what's going on here. I like the voice. He has a great kind of texture in his voice.
We'll leave that one right there. Lorraine Hunt Lieberson, maybe your great love when it comes to voice. We're going to go out with her, but tell us why she moves you so deeply.
Oh, God. I mean, I struggle for the words. I went to see her many times before her untimely death, and each time I saw her, I felt I had less to say. It was just the voice itself and the aura around it and a kind of a spiritual dimension which emerged, where you thought this woman singing kind of had the secrets of the world, was some kind of guide through dark places, and just extraordinary. And I just feel so fortunate that I got to see her as many times as I did.
The mezzo-soprano Lorraine Hunt Lieberson, most remarkable singer I have ever heard, Alex Ross writes. Of course, she died in 2006. We'll go out with her singing Ombra Mai Fu from Handel's opera Circe. Alex Ross, we love it every time you come. We hope you'll come again. Thank you so much for your time. The new book is Listen to This, and listeners, you can read from it at our website. You can find a link to a lot of the music that it explores. Alex Ross, today in Berkeley, California, music critic for The New Yorker. Thank you so much for being with us this hour.
Thank you, Tom. I really enjoyed being here.
We'll go out with Lorraine Hunt Lieberson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.